So good morning. It's a very wonderful thing to be with you all again. And I would like to come to our text gently and from the side this morning, starting with something that's more fun to talk about. And I'm going to have to ask you to participate a little bit here at the beginning. And the first thing I'd like to do is hear from those of you who are willing to volunteer to speak, things that you are really, really good at. And to emphasize my point, I'm so grateful for the illustration in the front of our bulletin this morning. If you turn to the front page and you look at the gentleman with 10 talents in his hands and his face, which if I could put a phrase to that is, I'm really good. Okay, that's what he's thinking right now. What in your life are you really confident at? If you were challenged by the average Joe or Jane, you would bet $100 on yourself. Just shout it out. Yes, I'm asking you to brag.
Making food.
Making food, says the chef. Thank you.
I'm a good organizer.
A good organizer. Thank you. Karaoke? Bad karaoke? Fair. Good to know. I would say for myself, foosball, that like table soccer game. I've beat many a camper as a counselor. Something worth bragging about, I think. Can I have one more?
Parallel parking.
We have an expert. Welcome to Seattle. That will serve you well. Okay. So I think there are many of us in the room who can imagine if we were in a scenario in which we were called upon for these things, we would be like the slave who was given 5 talents. You would have confidence in your ability to double down and really do well. You would pour your energy and resources into that piece of yourself. There are also many things in our lives I imagine we're a little bit more average at, but probably still pretty good at. So I would say driving is in that category for me. I'm not endangering people on the road, but I wouldn't brag about my driving. Is there anything that you can think of that's more of a mundane skill of yours? You're good at it, but you wouldn't necessarily bet on it. Don't be shy. Making food? Probably from a non-chef. That's fair. Stand-up comedy? Awesome. I'm learning about you guys. This is fun. Yeah, so this is kind of, if you look at the gentleman with the 2 talents, now 4 in the middle, he's kind of like, yeah, I'm good at this. This is amazing. I don't know who did this for us. The gentleman who's kneeling, burying his 1 talent. I've never heard, when this story has been shared with me growing up in the church, much about the fact that this man didn't have much confidence placed in him at the beginning of the parable. That's usually sidelined. It's not a really important part of the story. But I think that many of us know the feeling of vote of no confidence. And I think many of us have aspects of our being or ourself that we probably have vote of no confidence. I will not ask you to share on this one because that's not fair, but I will offer up, for example, my first summer in college, my mom invited me to do a belly dancing class with her in the summer, and I was going to say very German at it, but I was not good at it, and there's a reason belly dancing did not come from Germany. I'm very rigid and robotic, and it just doesn't look right at all. So that's, I mean, just a silly example of a vote of no confidence, but I think there are things that are more higher stakes and more valuable in our lives in which we feel really fearful. And I bet that if you were asked, you would bury it in the ground rather than risk trading with it, or rather than risk bringing it out into the day or to the light. So I start here this morning just to help us ground ourselves in the truth that for each one of these slaves, a part of ourselves could connect with that. We have in each one of us a highly capable person, a moderately capable person, and an aspect of self in which we have vote of little confidence or no confidence, accurate or not. We see that place of us as not reliable. The parable of talents, I believe, is a parable about fear and the difference between confidence and fear. And I think that's a little bit different than the way I've heard it. And I want to talk about a more common interpretation, because I think many of us carry these stories within us without recognizing that we've heard them so many times. So I'll tell you the way I've heard it the most. It may not be what you've heard, but I often hear that the gist of this story is about your activity with what God has entrusted you with. How active are you in increasing the store of what God has trusted you with? Does that sound familiar to anyone else? And the first two are really good at this, who I have dubbed the most awesome slave, who's the first one, who gets 5 talents in the beginning, makes 5. And to contextualize in the text here, a talent in itself is an extreme amount of money. To have 5 of them is ludicrous. We're talking about a master who might be a mob boss, who has insane amounts of wealth that he is entrusting in these slaves. So the most awesome slave goes out and somehow doubles that amount. I'm not going to go there on how that would be ethically possible, but it happens. The second slave, who is the pretty awesome slave, has 2 to begin with and makes 2 more. And they are both commended as good and trustworthy slaves for increasing their master's property. The third slave, however, who, as I said, is set up as the least capable from the start, is afraid. The most we know about this slave actually is that he is afraid. Everything else we hear about him is third-person perspective, and that is from the master who calls him wicked and lazy. But in my experience, the words wicked and lazy have taken over for this slave. He is a loser. He is lazy. He didn't even try. He just buried it in the dirt and forgot about it. He is the passive slave. When really, it was actually a fairly common practice at this time to bury your valuables, and would have been considered a very legitimate and ethical way to care for money. Okay? But we hear from the master, the least you could have done was put it in the bank, so I could have had it back with interest. And in a contemporary context, that's very logical, right? That makes sense to us. So as I said, I learned that from a young age that this third slave is a screw-up and got what was coming to him. Why not throw him into the outer darkness? And of course, the punchline is that the moral of this story is to all of those who have, more will be given to the point of abundance. For those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away from them. Jesus says that kind of thing all the time, right? Oh, you're awake. I'm seeing people shake their heads. No? What? No, for the sake of time, I'm not going to review the dozens and dozens of texts in which Jesus preaches the opposite message, ranging from the Magnificat, where Mary celebrates this pregnancy, knowing that this is the promised one who will bring the mighty down from their thrones and lift up the lowly, right? All the way to the Sermon on the Mount, where we hear that it's the meek who will inherit the earth. This is a very, very different message coming from the master of this story. And that should cause us to perk up our ears a little bit and listen differently. So coming back to each of us having inside us that highly capable person, that moderately capable person, and that person we're kind of ashamed of, who we'd rather hide in the shadow, I think it's important to acknowledge each of us also bears within us a harsh master. And it is a harsh master that frightens the piece of us that is not willing to risk. Because we know that this master is cruel and judges and punishes. It's worth noting that the third slave in this parable is exactly right. We have every reason to believe this is a harsh master because he punishes him cruelly for doing what he thought was right. Okay? So you've got those 3 slaves and that harsh master all in you somewhere. Are you feeling crowded yet? But if we think about it, it makes a lot of sense. I know for myself, I absolutely invest my greatest confidence, energy, and resources into the parts of me I think are really great, that I think are going to multiply and increase and bring back life-affirming and wonderful things into my life. I know that even in things that I believe this is true somewhat less, I'm still going to invest in those things. They are good enough, I'm good enough at them that I will risk, and I'm not totally fearful yet. And then that deeply tragic figure, the self in which we place a vote of little or no confidence. Believe me, I know what part of me she is. And I imagine if it's not too scary to approach it, you know which part of you that is. And she is afraid of the harsh master who judges all. And I think we all have that somewhere within or without us as well, circling around. And rather than risk, rather than try, we bury the treasure. We bury it rather than risk bringing it into the light. So I imagine this is part of our human experience together. And the words about abundance and the words from the harsh master actually sound like the shadow side of the American dream to me. I think in North America, we're probably, this parable resonates very clearly with us. Is the opposite side of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and proving yourself in the world and accumulating wealth and success and love. Is that when you don't do that, there's a harsh master waiting for you. You won't have to go far to find it. So when we read in the letter to the Thessalonians this morning from Paul, he writes, "But you, beloved, are not of the darkness. You are all children of light and children of the day. So then, let us not fall asleep as others do, but let us be awake and sober." It's an interesting counterpoint for this parable, isn't it? Turns out there is no outer darkness waiting for you, sisters and brothers. No weeping and gnashing of teeth. This parable, as I said, may be about fear, truly more than anything. It is about the obscuring and paralyzing nature of fear and the way that it reinforces us burying our gifts every day. Because the thing about perception is that it isn't always accurate. And it's probably true that I shouldn't be out belly dancing in the world, and I'm perfectly okay with that. But there are other things that I don't believe in about myself that by the nature of my not believing in them have never come to fruition in me. And that's what fear does. That's what the harsh master does, is reinforces, "I'm only going to give you one talent in the first place. Good luck. You saw that guy get 5 and that guy get 2, but you know what I think of you. You better be afraid." This parable is about the way that we prize and reward ability in the human world, how we crave the mere aesthetic of increase without even questioning why we're increasing. More, more, more. We're crazy about it. So Paul invites us today to wonder, what does it look like for me in my Christian life to be awake and to be sober? And I suggest this morning that to be awake and to be sober more than anything means that we are capable of paying attention. We are alert, open to relationship with ourselves, with others, with God. We are paying attention. And if we are paying attention, if we are awake, this parable calls us to see more clearly these favorite and least favorite pieces of ourselves. To see these favorite and least favorite pieces of others that we judge by ability. If we are awake and sober, we watch the harsh master with greater vigilance and don't call it God. If we find clarity, we are able to say, "I am a child of the light, and when I see you, I can say you are a child of the light." When we see another witness in the struggle, we are there to encourage and uphold them. When we are paying attention, we know that God never judges by ability. We might even recall that the gospel of grace frees us from that worldview, frees us to do the things that we are afraid to do, to say, I think there is more to you, child of the light, than you think there is. And it's okay if you bury your treasure. It's not the most life-giving thing to you and others, but it happens. Last week with the bridesmaids and their oil lamps, I've been a foolish bridesmaid more times than I can count, right? I'm always running out of oil. The focus of my deaconess internship is supposed to be work-life balance. They're like, you don't have any extra oil. You should work on that. And I think it's true in this text as well. When it comes to this unlovable and generally unloved slave, I know that feeling, and I know burying my treasure. These are things I do because I forget, because I fall asleep, because I become intoxicated by the messages of the world that I live in, and I forget the gospel of grace, and I forget who Jesus Christ has freed me to be. So, sisters and brothers, this morning I ask you to be awake and sober with me. We are together one body, for as Paul says, to encourage one another and to build each other up, as indeed we are doing. And if we are able to live into the way grace frees us and let go of fear, imagine what we could do together. Amen.